The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Welcome to Media Matters. Today, I'm Bob McChesney. I'm your host. I'm Media Matters here in WILL 580 AM in Urbana, Illinois. When we were thinking about this show over the winter and talking to the people at WILL, my producer and I, when giving the sort of people we wanted to have as guests, one of the first names that came up was Greg Palast. Greg Palast is an American investigative journalist, widely known around the world now, but really only recently receiving much of an audience in the United States. And he's one of the truly extraordinary investigative journalists operating today in the world, in the English-speaking world in particular. He gained his greatest fame in the United States in 2000 when he was the one who broke the story about the bogus felon list that was used by Katherine Harris and Jeb Bush to deny tens of thousands of people their rightful chance to vote. But that was just the tip of the iceberg of the corpus of Greg Palast's work. In addition, he has done extraordinary investigative work on the global institutions of capitalism, the IMF, the World Bank, the World Trade Organization. He's investigated the Clinton and Bush administrations, the Blair administration, the Blair government in Britain. He's done a tremendous amount of work looking at corporate involvement in the governing process. And it's a great privilege today from London to welcome to our show, Media Matters, Greg Palast. Mr. Palast?
Bob, Greg Palast. Hi.
Greg, I'm delighted you could join us, sir.
Well, yeah, you could call me Greg instead of sir. I haven't been knighted, and I doubt I will be.
Yeah, I know you won't be.
Yes. Yeah, well, thank you for the introduction. At the moment, I'm kind of recovering, trying to get over both jet lag and sleep because I was in the Venezuelan embassy in London last night till 3 a.m. On the phone with the Democratic forces trying to successfully undoing the coup.
Now, if I can, just for a second, Greg, I have not seen today's papers or press coverage in the U.S., but the coup, almost immediately after it took place, was welcomed in the U.S. news media. The New York Times, literally hours after the coup took place, had an editorial written which praised it as an effort to return constitutional rule and democracy to Venezuela.
Let me correct that. It's unlikely that they wrote that hours after the coup. They wrote it hours, if not days, before the coup. One thing that I should mention is the fact there was a couple interviews with me 2 months ago. I did an interview on U.S. radio, which is very well known in translation, Latin America, in which I said within 3 months there will be a coup against Hugo Chavez. No one was covering this. This is since your program is about what the media doesn't do, and that could be several volumes. Obviously, I have I don't know whether you mentioned the introduction. I have a book out of my I guess the samizdat writings, the stuff you're not allowed to read in America, of my dispatches, which is called The Best Democracy Money Can Buy.
Yes, in fact, thanks for. I do have a copy right in front of me. I just finished reading it. And I want to urge it to the listeners, if you're interested in what the issues that Greg's talking about in our show and this type of journalism, and I sure hope you are if you're listening to this show, I can't give this book a strong enough recommendation.
But what I should mention is that first of all, the disinformation about Chavez has just been horrendous. I mean, this is a replay of the coup and assassination of Allende in 1973. The only difference being that they have learned much better how to control the press reports and control the press both in Venezuela, but even more to the Western press. So that in fact, I was really stunned by reports in my own newspaper, The Guardian, which should know much better, and BBC, where I'm a television reporter, should know much better. And I was not put on the story yet, and one of the problems was by my own paper. They had someone supposedly down there, but what they basically, virtually everyone, repeated word for word what was given out by the U.S. State Department. And what the U.S. State Department said was that Hugo, listen to this line. This is the line you get in the New York Times, USA Today, Washington Post, The Guardian, you name it, every paper on the planet just about. Hugo Chavez, who is, by the way, the elected president is the elected president of Venezuela. He won with something like 70% of the vote, overwhelmingly. No one, and not only that, but then when there was a second election, they said he was very unpopular, and yet he won an overwhelming majority. His party won an overwhelming majority of the Congress. They had the nerve, these papers in the U.S. State Department, to say that Chavez was acting like a dictator. In other words, he was actually carrying out his campaign promises, trying to get some things through his Congress, which he did, some basic and simple reforms, long-needed reforms in that nation. So they said he was acting like a dictator, if you can imagine. By the way, his dictatorial actions were, number one, to pass a land reform law saying that those without land should get land. In other words, if it was unproductive land out of production, you had big, giant plantation owners. The rich of Venezuela own literally millions and millions of acres of property which they do not develop, and they simply hold. And yet there are millions of people living in shanty towns around Caracas. And he said if they don't till the land, then they have to give it to people so that people can move to the land. That was his first terrible move that made him dictatorial. And the second was that his nation was the number one exporter of oil to the United States, bigger than Saudi Arabia. And yet the oil companies are paying next to nothing to his nation for the oil. So he ordered that the royalties paid by the oil companies double from about 16% to about 30%. That still left the oil companies with 70% of the value of the oil. And as a result of that, of course, that made war on the U.S. oil companies, which as far as the Bush administration is concerned made him worse than Saddam Hussein. So that made him a supposed dictator because he said, give a little money for the people of Venezuela, that the oil companies owed something, and that supported social programs. Divide up the unused properties among the landless, and that made him a dictator. And we were told that he was extremely unpopular. No one liked him. All these people were in the street opposing him.
Yeah, in fact, if I can just add in, because I've been consuming the U.S. media,
yeah,
I think it was a unanimity that was even surprising to me that this was a mass uprising against the Chavez government.
Yes, and that everyone was so grateful when he went. What they didn't tell you, and they still haven't told you, is that last night in Caracas there were 1 million people in the streets. That's why, despite the fact that those leading the coup had tanks, they had airplanes, they had the money. And the U.S. kept talking about the transition to democracy. In other words, a military coup in which they put in, just in case you were wondering whether there's a money issue here, they installed as the coup's puppet president the president of the Chamber of Commerce. So they put in the president of the Chamber of Commerce, and the first words out of the U.S. State Department are, we are now supporting the so-called transition to democracy. In other words, from an elected – keep in mind the difference between Venezuela and the United States is that they have an elected president and we don't.
Yeah. Right? Greg, before you go on, let me just interrupt and say to our listeners, you're listening to Greg Palast, the noted investigative journalist and the author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy here on Media Matters on WILL. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. If you'd like to call in and ask Greg Palast a question, our telephone numbers are 333-9455, and the toll-free number is 800-222-9455. Greg, let's return to the breaking story in Venezuela, which I think is an extraordinary example of media misconduct.
It was the worst. In fact, I have to say it was the worst case of pure garbage propaganda I have seen in my career. And that's saying quite a bit, because I've seen the war in Vietnam.
But the worst case of pure garbage propaganda by the news media in the United States.
No dissent. I mean, not even a hint of dissent. I mean, the New York Times reports and editorial could have been, and probably were, written by the U.S. State Department. Certainly, it's the same exact phrases, almost exactly the phrases used by the U.S. State Department. And by the way, if you want to know if the U.S. was involved, the guy leading the military police in Caracas is a guy named Bratton. You may know him as the former head of the New York City Police, who was sent down there. He works for one of these what are, in effect, mercenary advisory organizations. So, basically, so the we had a our mercenary consultants down there. Obviously, the oil companies are more than thrilled to get rid of this guy. And they played things like, he's wacky, he's crazy, that is Chavez, the president. Well, read some of the interviews with him, which you can get from, like, the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions. This guy is quite brilliant. What he isn't is a Marxist, which is one reason I think that the left of the world was not too warm to him. He was kind of a liberal reformer. He is kind of a liberal reformer. He believes in land reform. You know, oil companies should pay their fair share. You know, the poor people should have a break. And then he was also attacked by the U.S. State Department and by the press right and left worldwide because they said he moved to take over the state oil company. Well, the state oil company is by definition owned by the state. It had been run by a general, and he had the temerity to insist that the general leave and put in an expert economist to run the oil company. And they said, how dare he move to take over to politicize the oil company. He removes a general and puts in an economist. I mean, the propaganda crud on covering this story is just shameful. And I have to say, my own network and my own newspaper really should hang their heads in shame on this. They're still missing the story. The people are with this guy. He's unbelievably popular.
Venezuela's a nation of 20, 25 million people.
It's,
and they had a million people out in Caracas.
Right. It was like, and in a way that's heartening, which means that even if the people of Florida don't really care about whether the votes are counted, at least they care in Caracas.
Let me interrupt, if I may, Greg, again. We're speaking with Greg Pallas, the noted investigative journalist. And we're very fortunate to have Greg here because he's been covering the Venezuela coup and counter coup and the return to the Chavez government to power. So we're just getting fresh breaking coverage here. And it's also, for a program on media, an extraordinary example of some of the weaknesses in U.S. news media coverage. Mr. Pallas, or Greg has just called it, the worst coverage he's seen in his entire career. If you'd like to call and have a question for Greg Pallas, the number here is 333-9455. The toll-free number is 800-222-9455. And we have a caller from Mattoon. Hello, you're on the air with Greg Pallas. Go ahead, caller.
Yes, I have a question that's somewhat related. Recently, there was a troubling comment made from our local newspaper, the News Gazette editor, Dan Kokery. About a week ago, I attended a community symposium about the current so-called U.S. war on terrorism. And Mr. Kokery was asked a question from the audience about why local events, such as a recent standing room only Friday forum at our Y, was not covered by the local news media. This is where the former U.S. weapon inspector, Scott Ritter, recently spoke against U.S. sanctions against Iraq, and there was a large local group of people present, but no local media. Mr. Kokery's response was, as to why there was no coverage, was because when Mr. Ritter resigned from the government, he was thus no longer a government spokesperson, and local media could no longer cover him. I see a problem with that. People are now forced to seek alternate news outlets, but that leaves a large segment out, and the mainstream media acting as an extension of only official government policy. And I wondered if you thought, isn't this a problem?
You know, Greg, before you answer that, if I can just interject, for the caller's sake, your book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, does an extraordinary job of going through exactly that issue, how official sources are sort of given carte blanche to shape what the news is.
Yeah, I mean, it's horrendous. In fact, obviously, this is one of the few times when they admit the fact that the only sources that they will accept are those which have been blessed by the government officially. Suddenly, a guy, Scott Ritter, who is 1 minute our government's official spokesman, and therefore he's a wonderful guy who's all over the media, and whatever he says is virtually law. Then he steps out of line, he loses his job, or he is forced to resign, and suddenly every word he says is to be completely ignored. I mean, in fact, going back even to the Venezuela story, in every single paper in America, I mean, there were no exceptions. They said Chavez resigned, and that was the reason why this so-called coup had some legitimacy, because he had actually resigned his office. In fact, no one had heard, they had never said who reported that he'd resigned. They'd never seen a letter of resignation. Where did this come from? It was complete, absolute government propaganda. And in fact, reminded me of the Chilean situation because if you look in my book, you'll actually see photocopies of CIA cables in which they talk about leading up to the first coup against Allende, which failed in 1970. They said, begin use of black arts and propaganda. Well, see, I used to think that was that they actually said that in the cable. You'd think that's only in John Le Carré novels or something, but the CIA actually sends out cables like, begin the black arts and propaganda. And I thought what they meant was begin the black arts and propaganda in Chile, in South America. Now I understand what they meant was begin the black arts and propaganda in the United States and Europe. And in other words, obviously people in Chile know when they're being taken over by tanks. The people in Caracas could not be fooled. They knew what was happening. What they're trying to do is hypnotize you and lie to you. This isn't about whether I think Chavez is wonderful or evil. This is about whether they literally lied in the newspaper. They were dead wrong. They literally took U.S. State Department sources as the law.
Greg, I've got good news for you, if I may interrupt. You are the most popular guest we've had in the two-week history of this show, and our phone lines are already flooded, and we've got people trying to get through. So if you don't mind, let's go back and give some callers an opportunity to ask you questions. Urbana, Illinois, you're on the air with Greg Palast. Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
I certainly can.
Listen, this is absolutely a miracle. If you go back 49 years to Iran, when the CIA overthrew the legally elected government of Mossadegh by passing out bills into the bazaar and creating a little mini riot, and they forced them to bring the Shah back, one of the reasons was because Mossadegh was interested in giving Iran a little more share of the oil money, and they used the excuse that the two-day Communist Party was going to take over. Otherwise, we have done the same thing in Venezuela, only this time we got caught. And I think it's a real tragedy that our State Department and government is so wrapped up with big business and corporations and oil that we're causing nations who are seeking democracy to end up with dictatorship.
Greg, do you have any comment on that?
Yes, I mean, it's the same story over and over again. But you know what you would think? You'd think that our media would get more sophisticated. The New York Times is so proud, in fact, about releasing 25 years later some of the inside CIA and FBI documents and Kissinger and Nixon documents about their planning of the coup in Chile. Number one, why didn't they do that in the first place when it was happening? Why didn't they look for this stuff? It was there. It was not that difficult to get. If you read in my book, I debriefed Ambassador Corey, who was the U.S. ambassador at the time, and believe me, he would have squealed to the New York Times if they'd only asked him. They weren't going to. But what's shameful is that after the Chilean experience, after the Iranian experience, and I'm glad you brought that up because this is a repeating story. To be fooled again in Venezuela is just absolutely stunning and unbelievable because it's the same stuff. But they actually did a better job of propagandizing and telling us that people didn't like this guy and they're so thrilled to get rid of him. And here the people rush out in the streets and say, you know, you're going to have to run over us with your tanks, but we're not giving up our president. I mean, just complete, absolute, stone-cold lies. It's not bending the information. It's not...
There's no gray area here.
There's no gray area. This is completely fabricated information fed to you by the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Chicago Tribune, and you name it. It is absolute stone cold fabricated information, which is dead wrong, which took about two phone calls for me to actually get the right information. It's not like I had to do some of my investigative reports. I have to go like undercover and I have to get inside whistleblowers and I got to get, you know, dig into the news or I have to fly into a jungle somewhere. My God, this took me a couple phone calls. I mean, to find out this is completely bogus top to bottom.
Well, Greg, let's go back to the phone lines if we can. We've got another caller from Urbana, Illinois. You're on with Greg Palast.
Hi, line two?
Yeah.
Is that me?
Okay. That's you. You're on.
Great show. Two quick questions. I remember reading, about a year or so ago, and I guess this is when Chavez kind of first came on the radar screen for me, about, the impression I was getting in the news was some sort of cultural revolution. He was shutting down museums for displaying or bourgeois art, that type thing. What do you know about that whole flap a few months ago? And two, what about these demonstrations a few days ago? It was unclear to me exactly what they were composed of. It seemed like they were led by the business community, but there were also references that called them labor protests. Where does labor fit into all this?
First of all, remember, I'm not Chavez's propaganda arm either. Number one, first of all, a lot of this stuff about, like he's the new Mao or something like that, or the new Castro, that's all bogus junk. But what we need, that's all more fabricated crapola and rumor and nonsense. There was no question that while there were a million people in the streets last night to bring the elected president back to office, the day before there were 300,000 demonstrators against him. There is a huge, organized, well-funded opposition. And yet, and obviously it's led by the business interests, because when they had the coup, literally the demonstration was physically led by the Chamber of Commerce. I mean, this is not like they're not like a hidden hand. They are the official leaders of the Chamber of Commerce is the official leadership of this opposition force trying to, that was behind the coup. And when they talk about labor union leaders, yes, they have labor unions. Now, I should disclose something too. I've been a consultant before I was a journalist. I was a consultant to labor unions worldwide, including those in Latin America. And when I was on this story, I asked the labor union leaders of Latin America and Europe, well, can I speak? I want to speak to the union leaders and find out their complaints against Chavez. And I was told by the most respected international leadership that these are not labor union leaders. They're labor union leaders the way, Soviet labor union leaders were labor union leaders, and the way that the Mexican CGT is labor union leaders. In other words, they're basically functionaries of the wealthy who run basically fake labor organizations. But there's no question that there is a real and true opposition to Chavez, just like there's a real true opposition to Al Gore when they took the White House without the votes. But you do have differences of opinion in that country. What we are being led to believe is that the people wanted this guy out is number one, that he had resigned is number two, that and also playing him as a complete kind of wacko madman who was doing these things which are unpopular among the poor. I literally read that in my own paper, which is shameless. Giving land to the landless is never unpopular among the poor. It's unpopular among the landlords.
We're talking to Greg Pallas today. He's our guest. We're talking to him from London, the great investigative journalist who's been covering the coup in Venezuela and the media coverage of the coup. If you'd like to call in, we have a couple lines open. The numbers here at WILL are 333-9455, or the toll-free number 800-222-9455. We have a couple more callers I want to get to who have been very patient, and I want to thank them. Yes, you're on the air, line three, with Greg Pallast.
Hello. Is it me?
That's you. Go ahead.
Okay. I would like you to review a little bit. Has there in the United States history, like since World War II, has there been more of a tendency for Democratic or Republican presidents to do this type of thing? Or has there been particular presidents who, under whose leadership this sort of thing went on? I remember, I think during Reagan there was something in Central and South America.
Well, certainly we had the Iran. Well, yeah, the answer is I don't carry water for one party or the other. Both parties have been involved in the Cold War and now the new Cold War, which is the kind of the globalizing agenda of the multinational corporations. I think it's been promoted by both parties, but we do have to look at the fact that if you bring up the coup in Chile, that was engineered personally by Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger, Republicans. Iran-Contra was, according to Ronald Reagan, he didn't know what was going on, but that was obviously the entire Republican cabinet. Well, of course, Daddy Bush says he was out of the loop. But that was, again, Republicans. And once again, while once again we have this heat and this complete bogus nonsense attack on Chavez, and one of the State Department spokesman himself was one of the people involved in Iran-Contra. So obviously the Republican parties are has been much more kind of proactive in overthrowing elected governments. So that's a serious business. And of course, the Republican Party overthrew the elected government of the United States in the last election. And that's if you look at the first part of my book, and I don't take this lightly. These are not hysterical words. You have to understand from the point of view of people here in Europe and the rest of the world. The fact that the guy that lost the vote, George W. Bush, that lost the vote in November 2000, is very serious business. He's not considered a legitimately elected president. And the fact that Al Gore runs out and says, well, our democracy has been saved. I mean, democracy to most people in the world is when you count the votes. They fixed the vote in Florida. The people of the rest of the world think it's very odd that the woman in charge of counting the votes, Catherine Harris, was the campaign chairwoman for George W. Bush's presidential campaign, and that his brother was in charge of the state where the election was quite obviously fixed. And when I say obviously fixed, you have to understand, this is an investigation that I directed for BBC Television and The Guardian of what exactly happened in Florida. And in a nutshell, in the months leading up to the election, 57,700 voters were targeted to have their names scrubbed from the polls. And about 54% of these people were black. Now, they were supposed to be removed from the voting registries because they committed crimes, and, you know, they were mother rapers and father stabbers and felons. But, in fact, at least 90.2% of them were innocent, but they were not innocent of being black, in other words, being Gore voters. The election was officially decided, called by Catherine Harris, by 537 votes. So you see that the disenfranchisement of black voters, the illegal disenfranchisement, and as my book describes in painful detail, that it was quite a deliberate scheme, that meant the election. And the rest of the world, my reports appeared on the front pages of the British papers at the top of the evening news in Europe and worldwide. I'm on BBC Newsnight, which is basically seen all over the world except the United States. And the rest of the world knows this guy wasn't elected, that he stole the election.
Craig, do you think that if Al Gore in November of 2000, after the election, up to mid-December of 2000, if he had slammed his fist on the table and said, enough is enough, I'm going to fight to get what I won, and had organized popular support and made this an issue, do you think he would be president today?
I think that we would be proud of our democracy today one way or the other. I think that it is shameful that people shrug their shoulders. I got to tell you, last night reminded me what democracy was all about, the demos, the people. People said, we elected this guy. And you have to understand, there were military leaders last night that told me that they don't even like Chavez. But he was elected. He was elected overwhelmingly and unquestionably. And it doesn't matter if the oil companies don't like him, or some labor union leaders don't like him, or the head of the head of the Chamber of Commerce doesn't like him. He was elected. And
okay.
He said, he will not be overthrown. People went into the streets. A million people said, kill us, shoot us, crush us with your tanks. Our democracy means something. And that happened in Yugoslavia when Slobodan Milosevic tried to rig the vote count at the last minute. And it happened in Peru when Fujimori tried to rig the vote count at the last minute in his election. And the people took to the streets. They didn't take to the streets to shoot or kill or maim or harm. They took to the streets and said, we will put our bodies on the line for our democracy. And, you know, I mean, they were, other people in this world chant, give me liberty or give me death. It's something which we have seemed to have forgotten in the U.S.
Let me interject if I can. This is Greg Palast. He is our guest on the line from London, the noted investigative journalist who broke the story about the stolen election in Florida in November of 2000, has been covering the Venezuela coup attempt. And we have a bank full of clogged phone lines, Greg, so let's get to them. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Kingston, New York, thank you very much for waiting so long. You're on the air with Greg Palast.
Yes, first of all, I'd like to say that it's a real privilege to talk to Mr. Pallast. I'm just a regular American person who's been brainwashed by the media over years, but little by little, I found out that things are not exactly as they seem, and over the years, I've begun to investigate. Now I'm at the point where it's sort of like walking along the beach looking for shells, and then you see one you've never seen before, and this guy is the real deal. I'm telling you, it's such a privilege to be able to talk to him because he's been marginalized. I mean, I'm talking to him as if he isn't here, excuse me. But he's been marginalized in the
American... Thanks anyway, though.
and suddenly he gets on the Bill Maher show, which is like, let's shout down your neighbor. Here's this guy with all this great stuff to say to the public, and hardly any of it got out. I'm speaking quickly because I have a couple of points I want to get in so I don't tie up their lines. One of the best things people can do is to log on to the Washington Journal archives of the C-SPAN site. And Mr. Pallast was on a couple of weeks ago, and I think that video is still available to see. And also, one of the ways I'm trying to help is that I'm getting in touch with all the local libraries around here and making sure that they stock his book. I would basically like to say that I'm wondering at this point when Toto has pulled back the curtain and we see that the wizard is this big, frightening fellow that looks like Rupert Murdoch on a pack of Victory cigarettes. I'm wondering what we can do to sort of break the lock of the corporate media here as individuals to try to expose what's going on and have people like Mr. Pallast's views, presented to us.
Yeah, that's the logical question, I think, Greg, that I have as I read your book, and I think that anyone will have as they listen to you, is what can we do about it? This is outrageous that our journalism isn't accurately reflecting what's taking place, but is serving special interests.
Well, I mean, I guess the answer, the whole Harry Truman line, tell the truth on him. Michael Moore, there's many ways we're trying to sneak the truth in. Michael Moore's book, Stupid White Guys, his opening, a couple chapters are based on my reporting. And kind of my joke is, the way I get my stuff into the United States is I say, get the fat guy with the chicken suit to sneak it in as a joke. And then, and I was on Politically Incorrect last week. Again, if I'm willing to yuck it up, I can be on U.S. television. But will you see my face on the CBS Nightly News or on my sister program, which is ABC's Nightline? They can use my footage and my stories for free. By the way, it doesn't cost Ted Koppel a dime to run the stories. And I guess that the propaganda from the State Department is just much more enticing than information.
That reminds me, Greg, of a comment that Ralph Nader made a couple of years ago when someone was commending him when he was running for president that he had comedians like Michael Moore supporting his campaign and how adventurous these comics were in pushing the boundaries of what could be said. And Nader's response was that this actually he found extraordinarily depressing because the only place you could broach anything remotely critical, he thought, was through comedy. And he said the country that this most reminded him of was the old Soviet Union, which had extraordinary political satire, but absolutely dead journalism.
Well, that's why I thought I said, hooray, if Ted Koppel goes, maybe I'll actually get a couple of news reports onto ABC television, at night. If Letterman uses my stuff as a punchline, at least it's better than trying to get through Ted Koppel's hairpiece.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things I would note is that, by the way, one way to see this stuff, remember, everyone's always telling you to stay, the powers that be are saying, stay away from the net, it's dangerous stuff. The only way you're going to find anything today is on the Internet. I got to tell you right now. I mean, yes, of course there's crap on there. I mean, after all, there's NewYorkTimes.com. But
could you recommend any specific sites that you...
How about this one? And I won't sell you anything there. www.gregpallast.com. If you go to my site, that's GREGPALAST, Pallast.com. So GregPallast.com. And what you can not only read my newspaper reports and my commentaries and my investigative pieces on globalization and all that stuff. But if you click on the left side, you can actually see in real-time video, most computers will play, you can see some of my BBC television reports, including the story on the U.S. election that they would not, that network TV would not run here in America.
And I might add for those who are saying, well, maybe it was a bogus story. How do we know we can count on this guy, Pallast? is that this story was carried by the most respected media in Europe. Harper's Magazine ran one of your pieces on the election, and it's marched at you, one of the most respected magazines in the United States. As far as I know, I've seen no credible evidence to say that your story is not dead-on accurate.
Yes, in fact, the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, which also, you know, the U.S. Civil Rights Commission said I was correct. I hadn't finished the story, the material I had up to that point, and they just got savage, just absolutely savage in the U.S. media. No one actually understood what it is they were looking at, but they said, look, this thing was fixed, and they said my information was correct. What I now have that I didn't have before, which you can get in the book, is that I know that it was absolutely a deliberate fix. For example, in those, remember the lists of felons, people who were supposedly committed crimes.
57,000.
57,000. You look on that list, and there were people that were convicted in the year 2012, 2038, 3014. You know, that was on the list. And it wasn't, now was that an error? Did they not know about that? Then I went in and got the emails, and the emails made it clear that clerks were saying, my God, we got people convicted in the future. And the Republican functionary said, well, the way to take care of that is if you remove the dates of conviction from the files, no one will know that it's wrong. That was right in the electronic files, which no newspaper reporter in America was bothering to look at.
That's nothing short of astonishing.
It's nothing. Well, there's two things that are nothing short of astonishing. One is that it was a deliberate fix, deliberately targeting black people to have their names removed who were rightful voters. And the second is that no one in the U.S. media cared. And part B of that, by the way, the Washington Post, which did allow, by the way, the Washington Post did allow me to write my story, part of my story, in a very benign and kind of bloodless manner in June. Now, remember, I broke the story in November. They allowed me to print it in June, and only after they got a copy of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission report saying it was correct. Now, once again, it's that official business. If I didn't get that official stamp of approval, there is no way on this planet that the Washington Post would have ever let anyone even hear a word of my report. And the New York Times would absolutely refuse to cover it. Absolutely just no way.
We're talking with Greg Palast, the investigative journalist based in London, where he's calling us today. His new book is The Best Democracy Money Can Buy that was just published, and it's available in fine bookstores. We've got, as I said, a full bank of phone calls, and I want to get to all of them, Greg, so let's go back to the phone lines. Line one, you're on the air with Greg Palast.
Hi. Marvelous to hear you again. And I, as usual, have 3 points. I don't know how you'll do it. One of your Newsnight segments that's on the your website is the one about the investigation into the suppression of the Saudi investigation and the strange case of O'Neill, which I think should always get a mention. I'd like for you to hear something about that. I also, since the IMF is meeting again in D.C., I don't know if you're going to be there for that next weekend? Yes. I understand that there was an example of you being suppressed, again, by an authoritative source that Mr. Wolfenson refused to be on with you.
The perfect media fix. And by the way, one minor glitch I'm running into. Oh, by the way, it'll be very hard to get my book in bookstores because we just hit – whether they like it or not, I did hit the New York Times bestseller list this week. And I have a tiny British publisher which simply has not printed enough books for the United States. So there's virtually no books left in America unbought.
Okay.
Now, the other problem is, therefore, I was telling people go to Amazon, but someone hacked into Amazon and has my book up there for $60 a copy. So I'm directing people like Barnes & Noble or whatever on those websites. I mean, I hate to give these. Or you can go to my website, and I'll click you through to any small – I don't sell the book, but I'll find you a small bookseller that will have it.
Okay, well, thanks for that. But
because it's been a real problem. But Amazon's been hacked into by, obviously, some right-wing nutters who aren't happy.
Okay, caller, why don't you give us your third point, and then we'll let Greg answer them sequentially.
Well, again, there's the point about Carlyle Group, and I think you're still under this kind of international swap suit, and I think that's a really important issue because it has impinges on the idea of how free the web can be, even. I mean, you're urging...
I'll do these quickly. Number one, and again, I'm looking at this as a media show, and so it's more what's the issue of what's reported and not, as opposed to just the content.
Yeah, thanks, Greg.
I did a story in which working with national security news agencies and others and our own source at BBC, for BBC Television, The Guardian, and we discovered that the Bush administration had stopped all investigations of the bin Laden family, except for Osama. You couldn't investigate the bin Laden family or the Saudi royal family and their funding of terror networks. Now, we had FBI agents who gave us documentation that they had wanted to follow members of the bin Laden family, and they were told, you shall not. And they were told, you can't look at the Saudi funding of al-Qaeda, which we had plenty of information on. You simply couldn't look at it. Now, this was not, and I don't want this confused, it's not part of some, I have no information that Bush knew about September 11th or had any, God forbid, any role in planning it. What we do know is that he said no investigations, and that has to do, as far as we could put together, with his personal and financial relationships with both the bin Laden family, the Bush family relationship with the bin Laden family and the Saudi royals, and their feeling politically, mixing their concept of their family's personal finance with their political viewpoint, which is that our friends in the Arabian Peninsula, the good old bin Ladens and the Saudi royals, we should keep our hands off and not annoy them with too many difficult questions about funding of terror. So we'll just go wink, wink. And any member of the CIA or DIA or FBI who violates this order now has their career cooked. And we had, I got to tell you, I had agents low and high screaming and hollering about this.
And this is a basically unreported story.
You couldn't get that in the United States media. You know, I'd have to take hostages to get that into the U.S. media. There was a little bit out of Paula Zahn, and I want to make this point. This is very interesting. She did that on her last night on the Fox network, her very last night of reporting with the network. In other words, and you could see how she did that. She took a little of our story and a little of a similar story out of France and said, can't fire me, my last night. And if you try to block me on my last night, I just have something to scream and holler about publicly. If it weren't for the oddity of her being there of picking it up to use it on her last night as a goodbye finger to Rupert Murdoch, we would have gotten absolutely dead zero in the United States. The other thing is that the Bush family, a company that George Bush went to work for after he left the White House, is a Canadian gold mining corporation named Barrick Gold. Now, you haven't read that in any of your papers, that after Daddy Bush left the White House, he went to work for a gold mining company. Very few reports on this. It's a really creepy little outfit. And I did report on it because I thought it was kind of interesting. And when I looked into the things that they're involved with, you could just get ill. I reported on it for my paper, The Guardian and Observer Newspapers of London. And Bush's firm, he's now left it, his former firm, sued my paper. Now, they said, we've got billions. My newspaper, the Guardian Group, which is the Guardian Observer Newspapers of London, we're like the Washington Post of Britain. But we are run and owned by a nonprofit trust, which has no money to fight billionaires. So we were being, just absolutely, just ground into dust by legal bills by these characters. That's how they threaten you. And in addition, when you talk about the Internet and trying to shut down the Internet, this company told the British courts that what I published on my Internet site, that's the gregpalace.com site, what I published on my Internet site or anyone published on an Internet site in America was subject to British libel law because you could read the Internet site from Britain. This was a way in which you can, in effect, nullify the U.S. First Amendment, because I got to tell you something. And did anyone react to that? Did anyone shut down their news because of that? Yeah, I can give you the name of an organization because we share the same lawyer, the New York Times. My lawyer is Floyd Abrams, and so is theirs. And they knew, Floyd representing me, about the threats from this company. They ran a story on gold mining in Nevada. This is the biggest gold mine in Nevada that Daddy Bush worked for. He's all mobbed up with it. They wouldn't run the name Bush in an association with this company. They wouldn't even run the name of the company in a New York Times special report about Nevada gold mining. They wouldn't mention the name of the number one gold mining company in America and in Nevada. And they knew, because they knew if they did, that their site is read in Britain, and that they would be subject to legal action in Britain, because this company sues just about anyone who even breathes their name. They operate like a secret society, virtually.
Well, we're talking with Greg Palast. I'm Bob McChesney, the host of Media Matters. We've only got about 8 or 9 minutes left. We have three people who have been extraordinarily patient waiting, Greg, and I want to get all of them on the air before we go off there, give them a chance to talk to you.
One question each, though.
Yeah, okay, you're on the air with Greg Palast. If you could just limit it to one question, that'd be terrific. Hello? Hello? Well, I think we might have lost them.
Hello?
Yeah, hello, you're on the air with Greg Palast, line three, go right ahead.
Yes, it just worries me tremendously the information we get out of the Palestinian Jewish affair, or Israeli. There's nothing on the Palestinian side. It's just 100% Israeli, like Arafat, you know, like we don't want him to be, deal with him, and yet he's an elected president of his country. It's the same thing, parallels what happened in Venezuela. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Greg, do you cover that story at all? Is that one of yours?
I cover the Saudis and their funding of terror, et cetera. I mean, I would actually have to disagree. I mean, you probably don't like this. We have a huge, huge concentration on this little tiny area of the planet. You know, not that I'm trying to say that we shouldn't care. But, you know, you get 3 inches on Venezuela, if anything, and you get endless pages on the Mideast. I mean, you may not like the spin that you're getting. Okay, there's a spin in the U.S. just like there's a spin in Britain. In Britain, you have a very pro-Palestinian spin, and in America, you have a very pro-Israeli spin. I don't really like spin one way or the other, but at least it's covered. Like, you know, for example, you even know who the opposition is. You know who Yasser Arafat is. You know probably all kinds of stuff about him. You know, there's a lot of information that comes out. I mean, I'm sure, believe me, because the Mideast is not my main beat, I'm not going to say that you're getting the full and complete information by any means. But compared to what they're doing in the rest of the world, at least if it's sloppy coverage, at least there's coverage. I mean, what have you heard about Bolivia lately? So I guess that's been my bugaboo. I just think that there's a lot on the Mideast, and we don't, you know.
Okay.
There's a prejudicial reporting, but at least it's there.
Okay, well, let's go back to the phone lines then. We've got a caller on line one from Eureka, Illinois. You're on the air with Greg Palast.
Yes. First of all, I want to thank you very much for your updated information on Venezuela. I think it sounds very accurate. My question is, what is your take on the, quote, war in Afghanistan going on right now?
Greg, have you said...
Well, you know, again, well, one thing I should mention is that I'm an investigative reporter, and I am a columnist, but I'm kind of a columnist of the old Jack Anderson stripe, which is, you know, to give you... kind of stuff you've never heard of, investigative material. I'm not much of a pundit. You don't need my opinion on this stuff, to be very honest. What I am concerned with is the information that is not getting out, and that's very important.
Yeah, what are the stories that are interesting you think that aren't getting covered, that an investigative journalist, you as an investigative journalist, you look at that war, and you're saying, why isn't this being talked about or researched?
Very interesting is that yesterday I spent the day with Michael Griffin, who wrote a book called Reaping the Whirlwind, The History of the Taliban, which he wrote just before September 11th. And it's quite extraordinary. And what he says is what's not being covered is about the viewpoint, frankly, of the Afghan people, and including things like the Northern Alliance Mujahideen. What are their views? What is their thinking? Who paid them? Who kept them alive? Where are they heading? You know, what's good and bad about them? And generally, they're just not getting covered by anyone, right or left, I have to tell you. So that would be one thing in the Afghan war. I mean, I feel that for the most part, for example, what is happening in I've been covering Tanzania. I would like to know more about the Bush family finances and their involvement in gold mining in Tanzania. I have a story in the book about Pat Robertson's diamond mines in the Congo. You can't remove these issues of money and our foreign policy. So that's what I'd like to do is say, where the place in the planet you're not reading about, because... Again, you didn't read about Venezuela, and suddenly you get a story, coup in Venezuela, like it just fell out of the air. Some dictator got overthrown, and that's it. Oh, and now it's reversed. So I'm concerned about what isn't covered, not even so much the coverage which is biased, but the coverage which is completely missing.
Well, now, you know, we're down to our last phone call for you, Greg Palast. Line two, you're on the air with Greg Palast.
Hi, I'll be real quick. My first question would be, I just heard this the other night, forgive me, on Politically Incorrect, and then I saw it on an independent media website. What do you think about word choice? One of the things that was brought up in the Palestinian-Israeli is the Palestinians, Israelis are murdered and Palestinians are killed. There's emotion on one side and not on the other, kind of the whole anti-abortion.
Yeah, I mean,
pro-choice.
Yeah, there's loaded words. We have the exact opposite, by the way, here in Britain, where Palestinians are massacred and Israelis are eliminated. You know, so it's the prejudice is mirrored in mm-hmm. in the opposite manner in Europe. Both, I think, are seizure of the language is one of the horrid things that's happening in the press. Look at the word reform. That's been seized by the New York Times to mean anyone who believes in tearing down government. Government rules which protect workers or protect the public or consumers is a reformist. I mean, which is like a complete inversion of the old sense. So when, you know, reformers in Venezuela are basically the Chamber of Commerce trying to get rid of public protecting activity. By the way, in terms of, I wanted to add one thing backwards
mm-hmm.
in terms of a story not covered. Not only the theft of the U.S. election in November 2000, but the theft of the U.S. Midterms elections in November 2002. It is happening right now as we speak, and I can tell you that they're fixing the vote right now in Florida. If you think that they were shamed about what happened in 2000, all it did was give them practice. They're emboldened. They got away with it. It's worse right now. No one is reporting that story. After missing the story of the stolen election in 2000, they're missing it again, and it's happening as we speak right now. They're fixing the vote. They're getting rid of legitimate voters in Florida, and they're not only doing it in Florida, but they're expanding out to 16 other states.
Now, what about, Greg, what about the Democrats in Florida? I mean, they're going to lose jobs as a result of this. I mean, what are these guys completely asleep at the wheel or what?
I got to tell you, I did meet to interview, and I want to get him on camera, the chairman of the Democratic Party, Terry McAuliffe, who I met last week. And all I can tell you is my summary is, and I'm not here to give advice to the Democrats, but they're at a loss. They don't understand this stuff. They can't figure it out. They're afraid to make their own case, and they just seem unable. They just feel quite a bit. I can't go because they said some things off record that, and therefore I can't repeat it because I did say I'm going to demand some comments on record in front of my cameras. Like, what are you guys doing about this? But what I can tell you is right now they are clearly outgunned, outspent, overwhelmed, scared, and cannot figure out how to protect voters. And you have to understand the racial aspect of this. The easiest way to get rid of a Democratic voter is to target and remove...
You know what I'm going to have to do, Greg? I'm getting the message that it's time is up on our show, and I want to thank you so much for being our guest from London today. Greg Palast, the author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. I'm Bob McChesney, your host of Media Matters. Our producer has been Ben Scott. Next week, Janine Jackson joins us.